Listener production. Claire Bowditch is a musician, actor, and songwriter. Her knack for telling stories through her music and performing has touched hundreds of thousands of lives. But what of the stories she used to tell herself? That real life only begins once you're thin or beautiful. That good things only happen to other people. In this beautiful conversation, Claire and I talk about the death of her sister as a child, grappling with obsessive thoughts, and how even on the darkest of nights, victory is closer than it seems.
I thought it was my brain saying to me, you don't deserve to live. I knew that those thoughts were lies. And I want people to know there is a cure, there is recovery, there is hope. And it's really about understanding and framing, why am I having those thoughts? Is there a different thought I could have right now? How light can I take that? And that's again one of the gifts of a tragedy that happens in childhood, is that you know this is not where this is going to end up. I will get well, but I didn't know how to get well until I found a book that helped me.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Working as a podcast and radio producer, I have been fortunate enough to cross paths with many intriguing people who have had a profound impact on me. In this series, I share stories and experiences from the people who have brought inspiration to my life, and hopefully yours too. Claire Bowditch's book, Your Own Kind of Girl, will inspire anyone who's ever done battle with their inner critic. Claire currently resides in Melbourne, Australia, with her husband and three children. Claire, in the 44 years that you've been alive, you've obviously had...
Quite a bit, really, isn't it?
You've had a colourful life, an amazing life, and learnt so much. But how was growing up in the Bowditch family?
Oh, what a great question. Look, I had a really, truly, fairly magical and pretty normal childhood for my early childhood. So I'm the youngest of five.
I know. How's
hey?
That?
Great. I mean, I was the youngest. I got all the attention. It was wonderful. You can ask my sister Anna. It's probably a whole lot of work for her. She was the oldest.
Well, it's like that, isn't it? When you're the oldest.
Where are you?
I'm one of two.
Awesome. So, okay.
And I'm the eldest.
Great. Okay. So you're the boss.
Yeah.
And you know what's going on. In my family, the youngest is always trying to be the boss, but she knows she's not. That's me. So we're all 18 months apart, and we grew up in Sandringham down by the beach here.
Yeah, in Melbourne.
In Melbourne, a rambling house with a dog called Sam. And, you know, my dad worked as a solicitor, then a barrister. My mum was from Amsterdam and she was a nurse. And, you know, my people are loving, kind people. We were completely Catholic.
They practiced Catholicism.
Oh, yeah.
Quite heavily.
Yeah, we went, absolutely. So they were pretty dedicated, but not, you know, in a...
Yes.
They became more dedicated later on in their life, but really... So the neighbourhood we were in was quite, we had a pretty glorious early childhood. When I was three, my sister Rowena, who was 2 years older than me, became really unwell and nobody knew why. And it took a long time for her to be diagnosed.
She was only five.
She was five, yeah, and she just started PrEP.
Mm.
And so again, at a time like that, you really grow up valuing community and the things that hold you together as a family. And, you know, just to get right into it, Rowie moved into the children's hospital and lived there on life support for 2 years.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So that was obviously a huge thing for your family, as it is for any family, and a horrible thing. It's always horrible when anyone becomes sick, but when someone so young becomes sick, it's hard to find answers to why that is. How did that affect you being so young? Did you understand what was going on? I mean, you were three.
Yeah, three, four and five. So psychologist Jean Piaget has a theory called the age of magical thinking. So this is a time in our brain development and in our identity development where we are really between fantasy and reality.
Mm.
We are forming who we are in that space. What I felt with my family was that this was all quite normal, that it was quite normal to go through this experience. My parents...
Well, you knew nothing else.
I didn't. I knew nothing else. And to be honest, you know, Rowie was still so alive and so... you know, her voice, her spark, her sense of humour, she couldn't move. But that didn't, you know, 3, 4 and 5, I didn't really notice that she, you know, I noticed that we weren't sharing a room anymore, and I noticed that she'd moved to the hospital. And I didn't consciously notice that she was, you know, any different from the rest of us, except there was this awful feeling all the time that we had to leave her in the hospital.
So how was that? Because obviously that was a massive, well, quite a big change to the routine. Mm-hmm. And she, as we mentioned, was in hospital for 2 years.
Yeah.
So you would go and visit her every day?
Yes. So basically our family life was quite structured and worked around this routine of us being with Roey. Every day Mum would go in the morning. I would often go in with her until I started kinder, and then I would just go in a few times a week. At night, Dad would come, and at the weekends we were there. So our life was really, you know, the norm for us was kind of being there with Ro. And they hadn't expected her to live very long, and she did. She lived for 2 more years. And again, you know, I've got to, it sounds really contradictory, and it's something I spend a lot of time trying to work out how to tell the story of in my book, because my memories of childhood are really different from the rest of my family, and these are shared stories. So I'm really only talking from my perspective as a 3, 4 and 5 year old.
Because you were so little.
I was so little, but I, you know, I always had this realization that the families in intensive care are always going. They're coming and going, and Roey wasn't. She was staying, you know, and they're going because of two things. Either they get well within 2 weeks or they pass on.
And how, I mean, obviously that was a horrible time for your parents. And, you know, being as little as you were, your subconscious mind is the thing that's driving you at that age.
Correct.
So you're just watching your parents and picking up their signs and their body language mostly as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did they change?
So my parents kept a really clear focus always on faith. This is why faith became so important to
me. It is.
Yeah.
Especially during times of crisis. Mm.
And their faith, fortunately, this is where faith is handy. You know, my father's passed on now, but my mother is with us, and she has maintained this strength of faith throughout her whole life, which looks completely bizarre to the modern, you know, the modern secular society. But for her, it's been this real anchor. And to be honest, it was that faith and the focus on love and the focus on trusting in a bigger picture, which we didn't quite understand, that allowed us to get through. So there's, you know, I didn't see my parents weeping. I saw them praying, and I saw us playing with Ro, and I saw us actually enjoying her. She was a little mascot of the ward, you know, and the nurses were extraordinary, the love they gave her. We'd make her tapes, we'd put them in, you know, for her to play.
That you would
make
up
songs, and we'd talk to her and we'd read to her. She was such a part of our life.
Well, that's a big thing, isn't it? The love of the community, and you do write this in your beautiful book. You say the community around you was such a big part, and you have so much gratitude towards that, and how beautiful the nurses and the doctors were at the hospital.
So they're the things that held us together.
Yeah.
And still, you know, you cannot avoid the trauma of what was really there all the time, which is we knew Ro was going. And that was a very complicated set of feelings to live with for all of us. And talking from my own perspective, I really got it in my head that there was something I should have, could have, or would have done that could have saved her. And I lived when she died with this horrible, horrible feeling, which is so common in grief for both adults and children, which is, you know, this guilt, which I realize now really kept her close feeling.
Yes.
You know, it made her feel like she was close, but I never really accepted she had actually died.
There's a beautiful passage in the book that I'm going to read, Your Own Kind of Girl.
Mm-hmm.
It's a passage about when Rowena, basically she has a near-death experience. It's beautiful. One Saturday morning in September, 2 years after Rowena had first moved into the hospital, there was an accident with her life support machine. Rowena suffered a heart attack and had what is perhaps best explained as a near-death experience. The nurses brought her back to life, thumping her chest in a special way. That was how it was explained to me, by whom I can't remember. Dad, probably. But there is the remarkable part before her little death, as my parents called it. She had been afraid to die. Afterwards, she was not. Now everything had changed. She said that she had seen something beautiful that made perfect sense, a place she found impossible to explain, and that she wanted to go back to again. Go back where? I asked. Heaven, said Mum and Dad. She was 7 years old and she said she wanted to go. As horrible and sad as that is, it's such a beautiful concept for your parents to have thought, you know, she's going to be okay. And this is, you know, knowing she was going to die and that she wasn't scared. Because I think a lot of the time, the things that people grapple with death is the fear of not knowing, like, where they're going to be once they pass. But the fact that she had had that experience and she got to see the light, and it sends me chills.
In our, again, in our secular world, it's really, really easy to find reasons why heaven doesn't exist and God doesn't exist. And, you know, that's a conversation that I, you know, I spend most of my meals each night of the week, you know, sharing with my best buddies and my family, many of whom are atheists, are agnostics. My mum and dad were clear on their faith, and no one, you know, this is a gift for them as grieving parents in an impossible situation, that they were able to have some sense of peace around it. I felt a terrible guilt that I didn't have that same sense of peace, because I was such a questioner all the time, and I tried to keep my faith really simple, and I've always hoped that Rowie was right, but I try and trust that she was correct. I'm not going to know the answer, you know.
Yeah, until
for a while.
It's your time.
So I love with this concept of faith that we can just, you know, it's a choice to trust sometimes, to keep trusting even though logic doesn't add up. But she knew what was going on, and that was enough for her. And you know that does mean a lot to our family.
Having faith and gratitude is such a big thing. And when I read that in your book, my grandma said to me when I was young, faith will move mountains. And it's funny because when I read that, I was like, I have a post-it note that when, you know, I'm not feeling quite centered, I kind of bring it out at work and it says faith will move mountains. And I just put it on my desk and look at it, because when you've got faith, you have everything. There's always, you know, it's going to be okay. And it is that faith that you see that holds a lot of people and drives a lot of people to like move through life.
Is your faith consistent or does it bleep in and out?
It bleeps in and out. But mostly it is.
Same.
Mostly it is.
That's good.
You know,
yeah.
I don't look at things the same way as what I used to. I look at everything in life as a lesson. So if something negative happens, I don't kind of think, woe is me. I think, okay, why did that happen and what can I get out of that to move forward in my life? So having faith, I think, is amazing. And then, you know, in the situation that you had with Rowena, I think, what more could one want?
Mm. Yeah. And it's amazing to think that there are families right throughout Melbourne, Australia, the world right now who are in this situation with their own kids. You know, we think it's sort of an other thing, but it does happen to people like us, and understanding the long tail of grief and how it can play itself out over a lifetime is probably one of the things I really wanted to explore in this book. You know, there's a reason I tell that very personal story, because I can't really talk about what I've learnt without it always being centred on Rowena. I knew from 3, 4 and 5 that we die. I never had a moment in my life where I assumed that we all lived forever. You know, so there's a sense of urgency in kids who've gone through trauma about we have to do something with our lives. You know, we have to make up for the one who's not here. But there's also this terrible feeling of how? You know, how can I possibly do that?
So you were 5 when Rowena ended up passing away.
Yes, yeah.
How do you think that changed you? Did it make you grow up faster?
I don't know if change is I don't think I ever really had a chance not to be in that liminal space where life and death are realities. And it can also, you know, that grief experience really mirrors anxiety, and what we see is anxiety. I think one of the positive things about it is I was always focused on let's find the light, you know, let's tap dance, let's keep it light, let's keep it laughing.
I'm sure, guys.
Yeah, come on, let's go. You know, the show must go on. So there was
there was
this nature, and there was all this wonderful sort of love around us too. But as anyone knows, when they've lost someone, there's a curious silence that comes after the death. It's very busy around the time of someone passing, and then it gets quiet. And then I was left really with thoughts, you know, curious and anxious and sometimes frightening thoughts about where is she gone? Why are we here? What if this happened to my parents? What if this happened to me? And I didn't speak them. I couldn't speak them because, you know, they were just sort of whirring in the background. So did it change me? I don't know, but I don't know if it's, you know, the chicken or the egg, but I was certainly someone who grew up with a complex emotional life quite early and spent a lot of my life struggling to deal with that. And one of the ways I dealt with it was through using food as a coping mechanism, and then later through using diets as a coping mechanism.
So that was obviously a huge thing, the food. And, you know, you mentioned in the book
that I'm hungry just thinking about it.
It was also the routine, because when someone is sick, you hold on, as you mentioned, to anchors that allow everything to be normal. And for kids, we know they learn best from routine a lot of the time as well. So how did that end up then manifesting your disordered eating?
One of the things that my parents cleverly did, and that they encourage you to do in these sort of situations, you know, the pastoral care workers and the nurses, they understand that, anchors are really important, and building in an architecture of sanity and stability when everything's actually quite chaotic is really important. And one of the ways that we did that was just a natural, normal way, which cultures throughout the world do, which is a regularity of meals. So, you know, fish and chips on Friday night, lemonade and crisps on Saturday night, and roast on Sunday after Mass. And, you know, dinner, my parents were very careful about how, you know, making sure that we still ate dinner together as much as possible.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, all of those things. And I remember, for me, a lot of my attachment with Rowena, because I was so young, is through, you know, my memories can be really clear and then really blurry. Mm. And I've had to ask my family quite often to help me fill in bits and pieces. The way I know Rowena and I know that experience, I know my love of her, is through the smells and the colours at the hospital and the songs that we sang and the foods that we ate, you know, the custard that she would be given, or the stewed apples, or the Samboy salt and vinegar crisps, you know. And I still find like I could have a night out. We're playing a gig in Newcastle. We've had a few beers. We've had a great time. We're driving home. We go past the petrol station. I will still go and grab that food unconsciously that brings her close. You know, I want her. So food can be this vehicle for bringing things close. But when you have this genetic disposition where I was already a, you know, what was called a big girl, I was taller than my peers. I had a big, you know, I'm Dutch, even though my mum's quite slight. I inherited that Dutch strong build. And my body held on to food, and I tended to overeat to really compensate. I mean, it just made me feel good. And it's funny, I watch my twin sons, they're 12 now. They eat a lot more in an average day than I would have ever eaten. But my body, for whatever reason, all judgment aside, really hung on to it, and I became a chubby kid.
And, you know, you talk about this in your book, that when you're younger, you hold on and you take things very literally to what people say, right?
Correct.
And I remember there was this one part in your book where a man that you met, like it was a father of one of your friends, called you a big girl. And he could have been just saying that you're tall. But I remember myself, I went back to my childhood when, I mean, I'm not tall at all, but I was this tall when I was 11.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I was really tall when I was young, and then, I stopped growing. So I went from the back row of the school photos in grade 6 to the front row, you know, in year 12. But I hated it when people would say, wow, you're so big.
Yeah.
Because they meant that I was tall.
So again,
but as a child, you think, I'm big? Like, what do you mean I'm big? And as a girl as well, that sometimes can be really confronting.
We haven't made it up. We don't make, you know, we with that feeling in our childhood, us, that childhood girl, that's not something that we made up. The society really does hold in high esteem women who know how to control their weight, control their feelings, and control their aging. You know, this is actually a reality of a modern society. No one says that to us directly, but we are picking that up because we're clever little girls. Yes. And we're working out what works and what doesn't and who gets attention and who doesn't, who's liked and who belongs. And we want to belong. It's a natural, normal thing. Mm. So for me to not be able to claim, you know, to feel that when someone said, it was actually a little boy at kinder who said it the first time, yes, and it really hung inside me, and then parents repeated it.
And I can't other believe in parents. Kinder is so young.
Yeah, but I was in pretty sensitive emotional, yes, state too, I think, looking back. You know, and I felt this bad. I didn't want to be bad. I wanted to be good. I wanted, you know, to not be any trouble for anyone, because there was so much going on. So this kid said, I was in love with him, Jimmy. I'd sing him songs. I love you, Jimmy. Every day a new song. And one day he saw me coming and he sort of did basically a, oh no. And I was like, what? And he said, you know, you're too big. Girls shouldn't be that big. That was the kind of comment. Mm. And it hung inside me like a bad smell, you know, in my heart. I thought, well, I'm wrong. I'm too big. I worked out as time went on through primary school that if I could get them to laugh with me, if I could make fun with my body size, the barbs about fatty bumbar or, you know, being too big didn't hurt so much.
Yes.
And I look back now and think, I look at those photos and I was just a gorgeous little jiggly kid who'd really enjoyed her body, and then suddenly, you know, I had to live with this feeling that my body was wrong.
And I love how sweet your mum was.
Oh,
and
she's so beautiful.
That's how good are mums like that? You know, when you're feeling down and you've told them that people are telling you you're big, you know, oh, but you're so beautiful.
You're a bitch, she'd say. You're Amazon. Don't listen to them. She was really, really, she just thought, you know, she wanted me to feel okay, but she understood.
But we don't listen to our mums when we're that young. Like, why don't we?
There was nothing mirroring her reality in society. Mm. There was, you know, she told me it's your insides that count, not your outsides. But everywhere I looked, you know, the only role model that I had was Miss Piggy, you know, a little tough, sassy woman, really. Everywhere I looked, Charlie's Angels or newsreaders or models on TV or child actors. If you were fat, it was funny. And if you were big, you just had no place. And so we look outside ourselves for identity all the time. And then I was getting this mirrored back, you know, going to shops. And by the time I was 10, I couldn't, there were no sizes for me in any shops. And I started having to shop in the women's section. And I decided one day after a day of teasing, I came home and I said to my mum, I think I already started saying it around 8, but yes, then by the time I was 10, I was done. And I said, Mum, I want to be thin. I want to be normal. And she tried her usual, you're a peach, you're an Amazon chat. And I said, no, I'm done. And she got it then, because they had started to worry too about, well, you know, is this going to cause a problem moving forward? And how do we help her with what it was clearly becoming a problem for me? Now, they were responding to what I prompted, yes, them with, really. We have different frameworks for talking about health at every size now, but we didn't then.
No, we didn't then. It was completely, yeah, backwards.
So off to the diet doctor I went.
Yeah. And how was that? Hilarious, the diet doctor.
I call him Dr. Von Thinberger, which is not that far away from his actual name. And again, everyone's trying to do their best.
That's it.
He points on a chart. He weighs me. He measures me. I'm like, he goes, why are you here? I'm like, what's wrong with this guy? Can't he? Does he not have eyeballs? You know, it's really in my head. Mum explained the problem and he weighed me. He measured me. He pointed to a chart on the wall and he said, this is where you are. He pointed to obese. I didn't know what obese meant, but I knew it wasn't good.
Thank God you did not know what the word obese meant. I did not know you then, but I promise you were not obese.
He said, here it is, and I'm going to, you know, if you do what I say, this will work out. You're going to be fine, you know. And I went, right, I'm going to do what this dude says, and I did. So over that summer, I ate very little as instructed, you know, and I lost a lot of weight. You know, it was
because you're so young as well.
I was so little. It was healthy, normal food, but there wasn't terribly much of it. And you know, we did as instructed by the doctor. I came back thin in grade 5, and it was a shock because
people didn't recognize you.
No, my teacher, my librarian teacher, didn't recognize me. The popular girl suddenly, you know, it's like I'd done something magical. I was suddenly a celebrity and I loved this feeling of being
seen. Which is also completely telling you the opposite of what your mum says.
It felt awful too.
That people only like the inside because they're suddenly accepting you.
Yeah. So I got this really, again, a really mixed feeling about, okay, so I like this feeling of winning.
Mm.
I'd always wanted to win.
I mean,
I want to be
doesn't?
But this scares me because it there's a crack in the world now. I had believed that my, you know, the only people who were interested in my fat were the people who were teasing me. And then I had this situation where I had these lovely mothers of my friends asking me if I could photocopy the diet for them, you know, handing me up sort of in the hall, complimenting me and telling me I'd done well and good, you know, good for me, you know, pat on the back. Everyone was trying to balance it, but it wasn't balanced. It was like I'd done something real special, and I hung on to that feeling and spent a lot of years trying to make sure I didn't get fat again.
As well as obviously having the food kind of obsession, I would say.
Yeah, I went there, people, ladies and gentlemen, I really did. Food, I did become a world champion in dieting, in failing diets. Like, and I did it all really secretly.
And, you know, back then as well, that was the thing.
Come on, we had the cabbage soup diet, we had the Israeli diet, we had the egg diet, we had a lot of diets going on.
Yeah, Atkins diet, there was a million of them.
But you can't eat too much bacon.
There was also the negative chatter in your head.
Yes. So this is probably where it's most interesting and relevant.
You say, who else could possibly love a girl as fat and broken as you? There again, there's a paragraph in your book that I'm going to read. Inside me, even in the darkest of times, there was a still voice that floated up, sometimes telling me I would recover. It would only bleep for a few seconds, but it was there. Mostly, however, what I heard was, I'm broken for good. Whatever this is, I will never recover. My mind is gone. There is a devil in me, and if I'm not very careful, I will end up dead. They would be better off without me. In the dead of the night, I felt the pull of these stories. I felt the temptation of them. But the one grace of this situation is that I really did know better. I knew these ideas were lies, tempting lies dressed up in dark sparkles. I knew that my own death was a line of thinking that, although I could not seem to stop it, I must never, ever indulge. I knew I had always known the truth of what grief really does to a family. Despite my obsessive thoughts, despite the story in my head that my own death was unavoidably close, I was not, under any circumstances, allowed to die. And so, at first, to make sure I stayed safe, I refused to leave the house at all.
Really, when you look back on it, you know, there was a clear progression from that first diet and the thinking that I was experiencing, the stories I was telling myself, because effectively this book is about the stories we tell ourselves and what happens when we choose to believe them. And at this stage in my life, from childhood up until the time I was 20 and turned 21 in London, which is sort of where that passage is taken from, things got more and more complicated and acute in terms of what I now know to be the voice of anxiety in my head.
And take us through why, how did that... I know I'm not allowed to die, thought come about.
So that thought, as just read out then, was a thought that I was having in London when I was very unwell. I thought I had a virus, but actually I was having an experience of PTSD. I was having an experience of panic attacks. I had no framework to understand what it was. It was just this terrible, terrible feeling that something very bad was going to happen. And I couldn't stop those obsessive thoughts. And I wasn't, by this age, I was so worried. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I wanted to eat, but I couldn't seem to eat. And I was very unwell. And I had to go, you know, a friend had to actually help me get home. You know, I was really unwell. And that was what I would call my one and only genuine, authentic nervous breakdown.
Yes.
Which... as my therapist, like Brené Brown's therapist, liked always to reframe as a breakthrough. But it took a long time to get to that breakthrough part. And this year, that passage is really from the middle of it, where I was obsessed again, thinking again about Rowena and her death and what I could have done, what I should have done, where was she, all of those grief feelings that I hadn't been able to process because I had a childhood brain. Now I had an adult brain and I still couldn't process it. So I knew I wasn't allowed to die. And that is a really helpful thing, because when you're in the middle of terrible, sustained, acute anxiety, as I was then, I'd gone from, you know, being pretty normal on the outside to having a breakdown. Your lower brain is always trying to work it out. You're trying to survive, trying to survive. And for me, that meant that I would look around and everywhere I looked, there was danger. You know, I couldn't be in buildings because I would imagine myself toppling off. I couldn't drive because I would imagine myself crashing into a tree. I thought, what is wrong with me? I didn't realize that is my brain's way of going, look out, I'm going to give you quite a bit more adrenaline. I'm going to keep you quite freaked out because I want you to stay alive. I thought it was my brain saying to me, you don't deserve to live. You know,
so
really misinterpreted.
Yeah.
Which is a normal and very common thing. That's why I like to say it out loud, because I think this is the set of thoughts sometimes behind some of the tragedies that happen in our society that can't be explained. And I want people to know there is a cure, there is recovery, there is hope. And it's really about understanding and framing, why am I having those thoughts? Is there a different thought I could have right now? How light can I take that? You know, because we get quite serious, and when we're tired and hungry, you know, it's a good environment for freaking the F out, basically. So I knew that those thoughts were lies, because I knew.
Which is a massive breakthrough within itself.
It is, yeah. And I'm very grateful for that. And that's, again, one of the gifts and of a tragedy that happens in childhood, is that you know, this is not where this is going to end up. I will get well, but I didn't know how to get well until I found a book that helped me.
When we look, obviously, at those kind of negative thoughts, do you think they all started manifesting from Rowena's death and not properly processing that?
Well, that's one possible theory, but I also think it goes back further than that. That's certainly complicated things.
Yeah.
But I think the human brain is wired to help us survive. That is the part of our hardware that has, you know, crossed itself across generation to generation to generation. This primitive part of our brain that says, danger, danger, run, here comes the tiger. So we all know this in modern context as fight or flight, or, you know. And so we're aware of this now because of our understanding of neuroscience. But we were also aware of it in the 60s, 70s and 80s. We just didn't have such clear conversations around it. So I think that's a part of my brain that existed. I'm wired for excitement and fun, and I have a gift for worrying.
Yes.
Learning to manage that was important.
I used to be the biggest worrier going around as well.
I was emotionally wired. And, you know, are creative sensitive types made, or does that get amplified? I'm not sure, but at this particular moment in time, I had no framework for it. So until I found a book by a really beautiful old-fashioned GP called Dr. Claire Weeks, who was actually, she was already, I think, dead by the time I found her book.
Yes.
It was sent by a family friend. And I opened that page because I was so unwell I couldn't read. You know, I just couldn't watch television. Everything was too much. Sounds and sights were too much. Mum tried to take me to a healing mass, and I'm like, Mum, don't drive so fast. And she's like, I'm driving 30 kilometres an hour. You know, it was all just too much. So I'm 21 years old. A friend, Kath, sends this book, and I open it, and it says, the symptoms that you were going through are all part of what she called nervous suffering. A nice title. The book was called Self-Help for Your Nerves, and I would have thrown it in the bin if I hadn't have been so desperate.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, this is not going to work for me. Just to have a kind voice explain to me, I will recover. The shakiness, the obsessive ruminating thoughts, the lack of sleep, this is all normal, natural reaction. You have a parasympathetic nervous system and it's been agitated, you know. And I went, oh, thank you. Okay, that explained it for me. And then slowly
funny,
I could recover.
It's when someone says to you, you're going to be okay.
Oh, isn't that powerful?
It is so, so powerful.
So isn't the trick of life then, and I've found this, that we learn to parent ourselves in that way, to
completely
tell ourselves, you're going to be okay. And that cultivation of that voice and the cultivation of the ability to name my inner critic, who I called Frank, and begin, you know, and I tell a five-year story in 5 minutes here, but that I began to be able to understand that critic is my survival brain. It thinks it's doing the right thing. It needs to be told to sit in the corner. We are just here having a chat and a cappuccino. We don't need to panic right now. There's no danger. So learning to train our own brains and tell ourselves better stories is really the reason I wrote this book. I promised myself when I recovered that when I was old, very old, let's say 40, that I would tell this story. My life in the last 20 years has been so fortunate and so glorious. I've got to live my amazing life. I'm still living it, and I feel choked up when I think about it. But I didn't know it was possible until, you know, I went through this experience, and it's just, I think it's probably the most important thing I've done with my life, besides having my beautiful kids, is tell this story and tell a story of hope.
I agree. What do you think were the key things in that book that helped you to change?
So one was a simple explanation of the physical symptoms of what I was going through. My mind was so tired and I just didn't know what this awful feeling was, this foreboding, this like the sky's going to fall down, but why, you know, this. So to understand what the symptoms of panic was central to me not being afraid of the symptoms. It sounds so simple, but it is. A panic attack is a fear of the feeling of fear.
Completely.
That's it. Completely. So once that second fear was taken out, I was A-okay. You know, I took, honestly, long years of practice. And sometimes, you know, before I was acting on Offspring, for example, I was so scared. I stayed up all night, thought I was going to forget my lines. The voice of anxiety still lives within me, but I know how to deal with it now. Mm. And I talk back to it. I remember that I am the boss, that I have a frontal lobe, that I'm a civilized human being. And that really helps me too. So there's that. But so taking out the fear of the symptoms and starting to just relax into them, you know, I applied to uni. I go to uni sometimes. I'd be in the lab at uni making beautiful angels out of wax and the centrifuge and, you know, heat. Things like that could really trigger me. I go, okay, I'm going to go and sit in the toilet cubicle for 5 minutes and practice my breathing. So breathing really helps, simple stuff like that. But what else really helped for me was learning to find a place to put all these feelings. For me, it was the creation of art, the ability to tell the truth about my feelings, you know, to have a conversation like this with, you know, a stranger where we can connect on these things that we are really human experiences, and to sing songs and write songs and get courageous about my artwork. It took years, but that's what was part of my healing and still is.
And going to that point of speaking the truth, because I think that is such a poignant thing for everyone in life. And I know for me, one of my mentors said to me many years ago, you know, Sarah, always speak your truth and do it kindly. And there's another passage in your book that I really want to read about that, because I think it's so beautiful. And this is really a big moment with Rowena where you're finally able to tell it how it is. And you're in the cemetery and you had found her grave. By the time I reached Rowie, I was so tired that though it sounds odd now, I figured it would be a good idea to just lie down flat on her grassy grave for a while and have a little rest. A little chat, really. I wasn't sure what to say, but once I started talking, I just kept going. I talked and I talked and I talked. Then I cried and I cried and I cried. I told her everything in my heart, all the guilt and all the horrible, intractable feelings I still live with every day in her absence. I had no idea where she had gone, I said, but I hope Mum was right. I hope I got to see her again. I told her I didn't get any of this, why we were even here, why we were even born, what we were supposed to do here, and any clues appreciated. As always, I noticed that once I'd spoken these doubts and fears aloud, a peaceful feeling came over me, relief, the relief of speaking the truth. It made me feel more like myself. It's such an important thing for people to speak their truth, but how did that allow you to be free?
My truth speaking, I mean, this is another act of truth speaking, this book. These are stories I've not told after living in public for 15 years with my songs in this detail, because it takes sometimes quite a while to work out how to find the useful bits in the truth. You know, the truth, when we speak it, it feels ugly and frightening. The voice of our critic comes up telling us we're stupid and idiotic and how could we feel these things. For me, the key to getting to the useful stuff was really having a mentor in there with me too. And that mentor for me came and continues to come in the form of a therapist. Mm. To sit in a room with the chap who we call Ron in this book, and to be able to, for the first year, you know, I couldn't, every time I spoke about Rowena, I would just weep. Mm. And that was most sessions. You know, I sat in there and I thought, what is the point of this? This is ridiculous, you know, and I would sort of try and shame myself out of crying. At a certain point, you know, Ron just said, he just allowed me to cry. He sat with me as I was crying. And then he started asking questions. I still couldn't talk about Rowena in public, even a few years ago before I started writing this book. I touched on it with an album, What Was Left, but I wasn't able to really go there because, again, they're shared stories, and also because it's, you know, I couldn't find the useful, I couldn't speak about it without crying. So Ron was like a ticking clock in a thunderstorm. He taught me it was basically I would tell the truth to him. I would say things that I didn't want to say.
Yeah.
And I would walk out feeling more stitched together. It would feel awful at the time. I think, what's the point of this? This is so silly, blah, 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 blah. I still hadn't worked out that I could have some say in the stories I told myself. I just worked out that I had some true things I needed to say out loud that were pretty messy. And I think this is where the beauty of art and music and creating podcasts and asking questions, this is where our creative life is so handy, because it gives us containers through which to stack these truths and arrange these truths in ways that, you know, we can pass on to one another. So once I realized that a song could do that,
yes,
once we started playing live and I started hearing back, thank you for saying that because I feel that too, I got braver. And that braveness is, I think, the cornerstone of any career, really.
And I think there's something so liberating in being able to speak your truth or be who you truly are and not care what other people think, you know.
Or do it even if you do care and you just are able to continue cultivating that voice that says, I have a right to be here. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with me that I want to be seen or heard. It's quite normal, quite natural. And maybe one day I'll do something useful with it, you know, like learning. I don't know. I've never got to magic and go, I no longer care what you feel about me. I am my own. Like, I care. Yeah. I love people. I want them to love me. I don't care what people who aren't in the arena say about me. You know, the Teddy Roosevelt quote, which my friend Catherine Devaney, who I lived around the corner from years ago, was quoting to me 10 years ago saying, you know, it's not the critic who counts. And I'm so glad that we have in this time people like Brené Brown again who help us frame these conversations. But this sentiment's been here for a long time. It's, I'll take your feedback because you're here bravely with me. You got something to say to me, I'm going to listen to it. But I'm not going to listen to the guy who's lobbing a tomato from the crowd. He can F right off.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it?
To keep counting ourselves in is really important. That's why I focus on this tool all the time of what is the story I'm telling myself. I don't get to control circumstances. I don't get to control who lives, who dies, whether it's cold or hot, what the weather is, you know, unless with central heating maybe, but you know what I mean? What I get to control, I don't get to control the first story that my survival brain tells me about how things are terrible and horrible and so on. What I get is some say in the second story that I tell myself. And that's really Buddhism, you know, in its most simplistic form, is if we can allow ourselves to listen and still not necessarily take it on.
When you thought about writing this book, was that scary for
you? I shook in my boots. You know, I promised myself, honestly, at 21 when I found the Claire Weeks book, and then I watched a movie called It's a Wonderful Life, this beautiful Jimmy Stewart movie, which is, again, about hope, a message of hope. And I thought, my goodness, imagine if I recovered one day and I got to tell this story. That felt like pressure. It felt exciting at first. And then I went, no, that's too much. I'll never be able to, blah, blah, blah. So I just deferred it. I said, I'll do that when I'm older. Much, much older. So I knew it was coming, you know. I sort of have known I made this promise to myself, but I kept trying to forget it because it's uncomfortable to tell a story this raw. But I had a song called Your Own Kind of Girl where I spoke for the first time about these diets that I had been, you know, suffering through quietly, thinking that I was just a failure rat because they didn't work for me as a kid. You know, they worked and they didn't, then they did, then they didn't. Diets work. The first diet works. The second, third, and hundredth doesn't. For me, this is my experience only. It's just a kind of setup that didn't work for me. So speaking about that was a reminder to me, you know, the song is called Your Own Kind of Girl. And when I got the letters back, when I saw the tears, when I heard from people that this mattered, it reminded me I had a story to tell. I still wasn't hearing Dr. Claire Weeks talked about very much in society.
Yeah.
I was always recommending it to people and they'd say, who? And I thought, I just want to pass on this really simple thing. So that's how I ended up finishing it. And I tell you what, I don't know. I didn't want to halfway through. I thought, I'm going to have another breakdown going back here. I'm going to write a book in 20 years about the breakdown I had now.
How did you get through that?
I'm really proactive about my self-care. I understand that being the mother I want to be and the friend and the daughter and the performer I want to be really requires stringent self-care. So I tapped in, you know, I get pretty clear on simple things like walking the dog, connecting with friends. I got a therapist who I saw regularly through this process. I spoke honestly and out loud with my editor and my publisher about the struggles I was having.
Yes.
I accepted support. Friends brought me meals. I was honest about it. You know, I said, guys, I'm struggling this week. There's a lot of other stuff that goes on with life, of course. You know, and they were, I let people help me.
And then now that the book is out, how has it been?
Well, it is exciting and more exciting than terrifying. There is always going to be a voice in me that says, you know, because I really don't know whether it's going to find its people yet. It's very early in it, in the adventure. But it's kind of terribly exciting and satisfying. And I feel, yeah, weight has lifted. This story has been sitting here wanting to be told for a long time. You know this, you know, the story that wakes you up in the night.
Of course.
And you're like, I'll put that off till a bit later. So it's a great feeling and it is exciting. It's been exciting to have some early feedback about it. But, you know, I think I'll write a light book of girly fiction next.
How did music help heal you? Because that's obviously a huge part of your life.
Do you make music too?
No, you should hear my voice. I definitely don't make music. Five or six instruments
if you
at
can
school
speak,
as well.
You can sing. I know, that's my life's work.
I wasn't so good at it.
Well, look, I have some very strong theories around music and how it can heal all of us. And I know that's sort of like, you know, I hear Usain Bolt say we can all run. Well, that's good. You know, I can't quite run like him, but I could run a bit slowly. I think the theory around singing particularly is also central. So one of the things that brought me great comfort as a child was singing with my mother and the sound of her voice, singing in harmony. Those things did come easy to me. But besides that, I didn't have any particular outstanding talent really with music. You listen back to the tapes of me singing. In fact, there's a little bit of me singing my first songs on my audiobook, and it's just like any other kid. And, you know, still to this day, there's a lot of incredible singers. But what singing does for me is it really connects me to my heart. And one of my favourite things that I've been doing now for 15 years is my audiences sing with me. They walk in thinking they can't sing and then surprise. You know, if you can speak, you can sing. Mm. That's it. You know, we can. The reason that's true is because you taught yourself to talk, you know, and the way we learn to talk is just to copy our mum and our dad and modulate our voice. And singing is no different. The thing that gets in the way is our head. And, you know, I've been running these events now since 2002 on this very theory. And that's one of the things that really heals me about music. Yes, it's healing writing songs because you get to arrange your thoughts and you get to make something beautiful of things that were complicated. And you get to inspire people. But the inspiration comes from them, you know. And so that cycle of singing live with people and allowing them to surprise themselves with what they do is really exciting for me.
If you could turn back time and go back and talk to your 20-year-old self, what would you say to her?
The one before the breakdown or the one after?
The one before.
Mm-hmm. I would say the words that I say in my song, Your Own Kind of Girl. I would say, you've been wondering when the answer's going to come. It's not going to come till you realise you're fine. You're more than enough. The real world needs real girls to love. Now, this is something I didn't know, and I know now to be true, that although, as mentioned before, the world does reward those of us who are able to control our weight and our ageing and our feelings, there are also enormous rewards and enormous joys and pleasures waiting for those who are gutsy enough to count themselves in regardless of the stories they tell themselves, regardless of their size, regardless of their trauma, regardless of, you know, their inner critic. Those who are brave enough to stand up and show the world who they are, I mean, my goodness, that is, I mean, we look at, you know, I was recently reading a beautiful book by a cook here in Melbourne called Julia. Her book's called Ostro. Whenever I see her, the way she is with food and the pleasure that she brings, I just adore it. You know, when I go and see Courtney Barnett playing live and showing us her in a rock, you know, I feel so inspired. When I see you doing it, standing in your strength, you know, it's really got nothing to do with what we look like. My mother was right. It is our insides that count.
Completely.
And the outsides are fun and glorious, but they just change. If you're brave enough, so I'd say to that young lady, and say, do you remember that feeling of chutzpah that you had as a kid? Hook back into it, because that is your salvation. Mm-hmm. If you can allow yourself to be seen and to show up, regardless of the stories you're telling yourself, you're going to be A-okay.
What's your heart's greatest desire?
I think my heart's greatest desire is still an impossible desire. Like, I wish I was magic. I wish I could wave a wand and have avoided some of the world's tragedies. You know, I have these very grandiose heart's desires. Yeah. My struggle is still always accepting life on life's terms, you know. So I kind of accept that maybe my greatest heart's desires are not, you know, it's hard to say out loud, but I can't change circumstances, and I still long to, you know, I still long to have been somehow magically have done a Lorenzo's oil with my sister, and I still long to give, you know, to have somehow magically been able to warn a friend who had a stillborn baby. You know, there's my heart's desire is mixed with that childhood grief and that regret. But truly, beyond that, you know, once I do my practice every day so I can accept how powerless I am in that regard and to step into where I am powerful. And so my heart's desire now is to keep passing on this message to anyone else who is doubting themselves, that you can tame your inner critic. You actually can, and we need you to, and we want you to. You know, we need people who are brave to step up. And if you can, if you've got the space for it, even if that's stepping up with your own kids or stepping up with, you know, who you always hoped to be, that little dream that sat latent, and you're getting into your older life now and you think it's too late. My great desire is to somehow magic you and just remind you to ask yourself again, hang on, what do I want? What can I contribute? You know, how can I be useful?
What is a life of greatness to you?
I've got to be honest and say that's actually quite simple. You know, a life of greatness is, you know, if I defined it for anyone else, you know, it would be impossible. But for me, I don't think greatness is necessarily anything to do with being rewarded by the world or, you know, winning anything. I actually think it's waking up each morning, and it sounds so simple, but it's inspired by my parents, who I love. And it's, you know, am I capable of choosing love today? It's that simple. I think that's if you can ask yourself that question and lean into it, or just live that out in action as much as possible, then that to me is a life well lived.
Claire Bowditch, you have changed already so many people's lives by speaking your truth, and thank you so very, very much.
I'm so honoured to be here. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my ebook, Finding Greatness, head to sarahgrimberg.com. And if you love what you heard, then we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. A Life of Greatness's executive producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Audio producers Matt Nikolich and Darcy Thompson. Special thanks to Grant Tothill for bringing this dream to life. For more episodes, search A Life of Greatness podcast, download the new listener app now, and listen for free.
Listener.